Привет, меня зовут Сергей Галенкин, вы слушаете подкаст «Как делают игры». А со мной на связи, как обычно, Михаил Кузьмин.
Привет всем.
Сегодня у нас необычная тема, мы говорим про работу с западными медиа. У нас гости из дальнего зарубежья. Во-первых, у нас Лерика Малаева, которая расскажет немножко про DevGam.
Привет.
Привет. Потом у нас гости Майк Роуз из Tiny Build и Кайл Орланд из Ars Technica, ранее из Joystick.
Hello.
Hello, guys.
Hi. Hi there.
So we're going to start in Russian. We're going to talk about DevKazan, DevNightKazan, and DevGam is going to be back to you guys in English. Да, для начала прошел DevNightKazan вчера в теплой ламповой атмосфере. Фотографии я вывешивал в Твиттере, я дам ссылку еще в комментариях к подкасту. Спасибо организаторам за то, что это дело провели. Спасибо всем, кто пришел. Я надеюсь, что мероприятие будет дальше продолжать развиваться. Если вы хотите организовать DevNight в своем городе, напишите мне письмо. Это достаточно несложно. А теперь к Лерике. Лерика, ты говорила, что хотела сказать что-то про DevGam.
Да, всем привет. Значит, я сейчас чуть-чуть расскажу про DevGam и потом сделаю два офигенных анонса. Итак, DevGam, если кто-то что еще не знает о нем. Если бы я сейчас была инди-разработчиком, то я бы обязательно поехала на DevGam, потому что это будет первое мероприятие такого уровня у нас в стране. У вас в стране. Такого звездного состава зарубежных
игр. У Миши в стране,
в какой-то момент я поняла, что самое главное в мероприятиях — это все-таки контент, и начала фокусироваться именно на нем. Вот. Весь этот год я ездила и строила контакты по всему миру, на PAX, на GDC, на кучу других мероприятий. Именно поэтому у нас в этом году будут такие офигенные крутые спикеры, которые будут делиться своим опытом. И, кстати, у нас будет синхронный перевод всех иностранных лекций, если вы некомфортно отлично чувствуете себя с английским.
То есть, чтобы вы понимали... В случае, конечно, ну да.
Нам для этого подкаста нужен синхронный перевод, там в чате негодуют.
Да. То есть у нас будет Даниэль Розенфилд, это саунд-дизайнер Майнкрафта. У нас будет Елена Харрисон из Electronic Adice, лид-артист она на проекте Battlefield 4. У нас будут ребята из Польши, которые 11-bit Studio, которые сделали This World of Mine, которая взяла одну из номинаций на MGF. В общем, чтобы вы понимали, 95% контента — это именно разработка, геймдизайн, графика, звук, маркетинга вообще практически не будет. И причем также у нас будет про выход на различные платформы, и это и об Xbox, и о PlayStation мы будем говорить, и о Wii U, и о Steam, и Facebook. У нас, кстати, даже будет закрытый iOS-воркшоп от компании, которую нельзя называть, потому что ее представители не могут делать доклады публично. Вот, поэтому там требуется предварительная регистрация. Но компанию вы все хорошо знаете, она торгует фруктами. Вот, да. Вот. Вообще, DevGam — это не только доклады, и если вы планируете приехать первый раз, то обратите внимание, что у нас есть куча других различных активностей, то есть это там Speed Game Dating, например, где 20 разработчиков, 20 издателей встречаются за один час, трехминутные встречи. Вот. У нас есть Game Showcase, где вы можете показать свои проекты коллегам по индустрии, причем он разделен на 4 потока, и вам надо будет провести за стендом всего 3-4 часа. А этого времени вполне достаточно, чтобы сделать личный плейтест игре, получить фидбэк, остальное время — нетворкинг, доклады, пати и все такое прочее. Кстати, мы увеличили количество столиков и можем принять еще 20 проектов, поэтому до 5 мая вы можете еще присылать заявки, чтобы поучаствовать в шоу-кейсе. Вот. Есть еще Game Lynch, но мы не будем сейчас о нем. Потом еще мы делаем там нетворкинг-стикеры, стена вакансий, в общем, куча разного. И вечеринки. У нас их будет 2.
Самое главное, надо с этого было начинать.
Самое главное.
Да.
Да, доклады какие-то там, Apple, вечеринки.
Какие-то доклады, да. У нас будет одна чарбуз припати 14 мая, это за день до конференции. То есть все бухать начнут еще за день до. Вот. Вы там можете получить свой бейджик, пообщаться, в общем, будет офигенски. И у нас будет Bye-bye Mingle, спонсирован нашим любимым Ренатусом, который будет на самой конференции сразу после торжественной церемонии награждения DevGam Awards, которую тоже нельзя пропускать. Вот. А вот 15 мая у нас после окончания доклада вечеринки не будет, но будет кое-что более крутое, и тут, внимание, анонс первый. Итак, впервые в России на DevGam будет эксклюзивная премьера документального фильма «Game Loading: The Rise of Indies» с русской локализацией. Чтобы вы понимали масштаб, это кино уровня Indie Games and Movie. В общем, всем срочно смотреть трейлер. Создатели этого фильма, Лестер и Анна, они сами родом из Австралии. Они последние три года путешествовали по всему миру. По Америке, Европе, по различным шоу, конференциям. И снимали инди-разработчика. То есть в фильме зафичерены такие разработчики успешных игр, как Stanley Parable, Peppers Please, Minecraft, Thomas Was Alone, Ridiculous Fishing. А, кстати, Рами Измаил из Вламбира, который сделали Ridiculous Fishing, и он тоже был, есть в этом фильме, он будет тоже выступать у нас на DevGam с докладом, с ним можно будет пообщаться. Вот. В общем, фильм будет на английском языке, но с русскими субтитрами. И перевод делают Юля Вахрушева из Tiny Build и ребята из компании Alcanoz. Вот, так что, опять же, шикарная возможность. Вход будет свободный для всех участников DevGam. Причем крупным медиа мы разыгрываем билеты на премьеру, ну, крупные медиа от нашего лица разыгрывают билеты на премьеру среди простых смертных. То есть можете выиграть приглашение именно на премьеру. Это не даст доступа на саму конференцию, а только на фи. Вот.
Я немножко прослушал, Лерика, он будет демонстрироваться в каком-то кинозале отдельном, в том же месте, где происходит конференция?
Да-да-да. Ты помнишь тот зал? Там 600 мест.
А, окей, все.
Еще то есть куча на всех хватит. Ступенек, то есть туда можно 800 человек запихнуть. В случае чего. И он будет с начала в 6:30.
А с попкорном можно заходить?
Можно.
Как раз 15 числа, как раз когда моя лекция закончится к тому моменту. А, я 16 выступаю.
Ты 16-го, фильм 15-го.
Окей, ладно.
Я доклад Галенкина.
Да, кстати, помимо всего этого великолепия, можно будет встретиться с Сергеем и со мной.
Так что Миша, если... там целый зал занял.
Угу. Да. Я, правда, еще даже не зарегистрировался, даже билет еще не купил.
А тебе не надо?
Ну, нет, я в смысле, мне даже регистрироваться не надо. Я еще просто коллег хочу с собой привезти немножко, наверное. Не знаю. Ну, да. Окей. Вот видите, если хотите бесплатно попасть на DevGam, вам надо взять зал. Или быть Михаилом.
Окей.
Бесплатно на DevGam можно попасть... любыми способами.
Да,
у вас, например, есть волонтерская программа. Один день помогаете, второй день спокойно участвуете бесплатно.
Вот, хороший способ. А волонтеры у вас что делают?
Куча всякой. Access control, модерация залов, регистрация. Там на сайте есть вся информация.
Окей.
Так, и
второй анонс. Так, быстренько. Итак, следующая DevGam после московского состоится 10-11 сентября в Гамбурге.
Тут нужно кричать. Тут нужно кричать, виза нужна.
Так вот. Значит, ребят, смотрите. Я вам честно скажу, вывести DevGam в Западную Европу — это была моя давняя-давняя мечта. Мы работали над этим последние 2 года. Мы пересмотрели кучу стран, кучу городов, но в итоге выбрали Гамбург. Там огромное комьюнити инди-разработчиков, и не только, там крупных компаний огромное количество, большое штук. Вот. И в Гамбург легко добраться, там самолеты, паромы, Wizz Air летает из Киева, дешевые, очень напрямую. И самое главное, у нас будет... визовая поддержка от Local Government Hamburg.
То есть мы Гамбург, будем высылать... Помню, есть еще программа поддержки местных разработчиков, если я не ошибаюсь. Потому что они, у Гамбурга есть стенд на Gamescom регулярный.
Да, DevGam там будет. Да, у них есть огромная комьюнити. То есть вот как мы запулили анонс DevGam'а, немецкие, все, нам моментально начали все писать, типа, а что, где, когда, а мы еще даже сайт не запустили.
Ну, по крайней мере, вот. Это... Миш, где у нас был в прошлый раз мероприятие, где мы... В Таиланд, что ли?
У нас в Таиланде?
Нет, не у нас в Таиланде, предыдущий гость говорил про таиландское мероприятие.
Мы тогда наверное.
Сингапур, да. Мы тогда еще очень удивлялись, что вот дороговато туда лететь.
Да, про Сингапур.
900 евро. Ну, я вот посмотрел Гамбург, туда-обратно получается 990 гривен, то есть это сколько, 50 евро примерно, из Киева. Ну, окей.
Из Эр?
Да, из Эр.
Из Вильнюса новые лоукосты полетели.
А нет, в одну сторону
писать, извините. Из Калининграда вообще легко там на пароме добраться можно. Ленинградских разработчиков. Так вот, про визы. По этим приглашениям, которые будут высылаться почтой FedEx, вот, по ним отказ всего лишь меньше 5%. То есть практически 100% гарантированная виза в Германию.
Если что, в Германии сейчас, ну, я про Украину скажу, они выдают через визовый центр, поэтому там отказов ноль, если вы правильно подаете документы. Раньше выдавали через посольство, было сложнее. Сейчас все проще. Окей, это интересная новость. Я не могу сказать, что я страшно рад переезду в Гамбург, потому что раньше был в Киеве.
Вот, мы три шоу делаем.
А, три шоу? Окей.
Да.
А в Киев вернетесь?
Смотри, я всем это говорю. Я после московской конференции, я еду в Киев смотреть две площадки. Если одна из них подойдет, потому что нам нужно уже на 1500 человек и больше, то мы, скорее всего, вернемся в Киев. Если не подойдет, то мы в этом году сделаем в Минске, а на следующий год опять будем думать на Киев.
Окей.
То есть в конце мая мы будем знать.
Не, мне Минск тоже нравится, если что.
Но
просто как бы Киев ближе.
Я понимаю.
Да. Окей, спасибо, Лерика. На Гамбург, готовьтесь к Гамбургу, встретимся в Москве на DevGamme. And I think we're back to you guys. Sorry for taking so long. Lerika was talking about DevGamme. She's moving to Hamburg. And it got her a little bit excited, overexcited, I'd say.
Sorry, it was very interesting. I was following along perfectly.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about a little bit about news right now. So the big news is that Valve introduced and then cancelled paid mods. And I think we talked about last time, right, Michael?
Yep. We talked about they opened this opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah,
we haven't discussed about the closing.
Yeah, the closure. So it was surprising for us that it wasn't surprising that Valve decided to close it. It was surprising that people were against it. I was actually quite surprised. But then I learned that modders are relying on each other's work, and introducing money into this wasn't really welcomed. So that's why modders were against it. Have you got any thought about it? Because I think every media was writing about it like crazy. It's the last days.
It seemed really messy the way they did it, right? Like, it seems like there's something there, and there's something that they could be doing, but it just seemed like the way that Valve just sort of just went, oh, there's a thing, make some money. It just seemed like they hadn't really thought it through very well. And so people went crazy, basically.
Yeah, like, some of the backlash to me, I think, was because the quality of the modding that people were charging for really wasn't there. There were a lot of more detailed horses or adult type of mods, the kind of stuff you usually would find for free, except they were now charging for it. And also the fact that Bethesda and Valve set 25% revenue share for the actual mod creators seemed really low to a lot of people. And I gotta agree, 70% is usually what you get as an app maker on these stores.
Yeah,
now, mod maker, you're not actually making the app, you're just adding to it, but 25% still seems low.
Hey, have you read an opinion article by Dean Hall about it? He said that it's not your game, it's you're using an already existing IP for 25%. And from this point of view, 25% is actually quite okay. It's not generous, obviously, but it's okay. I think the most problem wasn't in 25% versus 50% or 70%. People were angry because everybody used to have and used to use everyone's code and everyone's assets. So if you wanted to create a mod with detailed horses, you just took someone else's horses and combined them into a new mod. And now people started to sell stuff, and it was messy. That's another way to say it.
Very few people were selling things. I think the vast majority of people were still, if you wanted to take part in that free community and release everything for free, you still could. The idea here was to encourage people who, might not have the free time to devote to it without actually making money to actually get into the modding scene. And, in the, 4 days it was up, I don't really think we had a chance to see if that would happen or not. It would have to be up for a few months at least before we could see if there's really a business to be made.
I think it was a shock as well, right? Because as far as I am aware, they hadn't talked about it before. It just all of a sudden happened.
Yeah.
And so I think part of it was just the shock of it happening, because this was just like it doesn't sound like much when you say out loud what they did, but if you take how many years people have been making mods and the modding scene has been going, and all of a sudden go, hey, we're gonna start doing this now with money, then just to do that out of the blue is obviously going to make people go crazy regardless of how you handle it. So
if they had gone to some of the mod communities and quietly said, this is what we're thinking of doing, what do you think, could you start making some mods that you really think are worth charging for, and then when we launch in a few months we'll have something ready, we can work out the kinks. But yeah, I don't think they did that at all.
Yeah, and you know, it's a pity that it haven't took off, because we had people from, I don't know how to say it, Hats Industry for Dota and Team Fortress that are making assets for sale, and well, they were talking about how Valve is not really responsive and everything, but they were also talking about how people are making a living doing Hats. And that's actually quite good, right? So you don't have to have a day job. If you have a hobby and this hobby makes you money, that's actually how we do. I mean, my hobby is developing games. I love games, and I'm able to make money by developing games. And I really would like to modders to be able to do the same way, you know.
That's true. And I believe the hat market also, they share 25% with the makers of the hats.
No, I think it's 50, actually.
That's up to 50?
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure. I need to check it, but I think it's more generous.
Yeah, because it's Valve IP, so
yeah.
They don't split it with game developers.
Ah, I see.
Okay. It's not 70, but it's more fair. It's like, I think the same with tickets. They charge 50% for tickets if you want to sell tickets for your event at Dota 2. So I think it's the same.
We had a podcast with Dota 2 developers. Yeah. Not developers, just mod.
We had with developers as well, but yeah.
Item developers.
Yeah.
50% sounds about right for building on someone else's game to me. 25% is a little low, but that's just off the top of my head what I feel is fair.
Okay, and another news topic is that Game Jam Kanobu, organized by Kanobu and obviously Oleg Chimakov, got to an end, and they got winners. I think winners will be present at DevGam. Okay, Lyric is muted, so she can't.
Yeah, she they can't. Will.
Okay, they will. I think someone, will be even present at Games Lynch. So the winner is Paper Knight, the Grand Prix. It took a prize money, but well, prize money aren't big. I think it's most important is at this stage is the attention the game gets. And then we got Scrap Garden, we got Steeler, that was already featured by, I think, Rock Paper Shotgun, but then it was cancelled and then got uncancelled. And that's really good, because I really like how Steeler looks. And Steam Fair, a lot of games, actually. It's a lot of really good games. I sent the link to guys before podcast. I don't know if you saw it. I think Mike saw it before, right?
Yeah.
I don't think I had a chance.
I was kind of helping out to kind of help choose the finalists, basically. So yeah, I've had a look at a lot of them.
Yeah. So what do you think?
Yeah. So I was saying to you just before we started, like, I was surprised by how many games there were, because. I think a lot of Russian devs, and for whatever reason it is, they don't want to talk about their game. Like they don't want to tell like the press, like the Western press, like Rock Paper Shotgun and Kotaku, etc., about all these games.
So yeah, they don't talk to Russian press. It's not like they don't like American press. They don't talk to any press at all.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, and I don't understand why, because, you know, like I said, there was like over 300 games submitted into this, which I think it was only like a few years ago that like the IGF, the Independent Game Festival, was getting that many entries. So it's a lot of games, and there's loads of really good ones in there, like some of the ones you were just naming. I was going through just finding game after game that I'd never heard of before that looked amazing, and I was going crazy, like thinking, why are these developers not telling the press about their games? I don't understand. So I think someone needs to shout at all these developers and tell them, you're making good games, tell someone about it.
That's why we actually decided on a topic for this podcast is getting into international media. So we had a lot of discussion. We had guests from several Russian outlets here that were, the idea was simple, just cut them, write something about the game, But well, that's for Russian media, because Russian media doesn't get too much letters from Russian developers. And, you know, Russian developers in Russian media's heart is always has a special place. But let's talk about international media. So let's start with guests, right, Mike? We usually talk about...
Yeah, some small introduction of yourselves.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. I'll do that. Okay. So my name is Mike Rose. I used to write about video games for a long time, so about 8 years. I wrote for Gamasutra most recently. I also wrote for Kotaku and Pocket Gamer and IndieGames.com. Lots of places. And now I am at Tiny Build Games. Which, interestingly enough, I got that job from when I went to DevGam at the end of last year.
because so Lurica owes us a lot of money.
Obviously I went there and I gave a talk there. And did the game launch, etc. And then I got very drunk with Alex, who is the CEO of Tiny Build.
And he drunk said, at Game Lynch or a year later.
Well, let's say both. And he said, "Hey, you should work for us." And I said, "Okay." And that was about it, really. But that's what I've been doing. And at Tiny Build, I basically look for games for Tiny Build to publish. So obviously, looking through all of these Russian games was extremely interesting to me, because I'm looking, finding all of these amazing games all of a sudden, going, "Wow, where have these been hiding?" So that's what I'm up to at the moment.
And Kyle, could you talk about yourself a little bit?
Sure. I'm Kyle Orland. I've been freelancing journalism about video games for a little over 10 years now. I got my start at the college paper and moved on to Joystick, NPR. I wrote a little for Crispy Gamer, Gamasutra, Electronic Gaming Monthly, a bunch of other places you may not have heard of. Now I'm full-time for ArsTechnica.com as their gaming editor. It's a technology site, but I'm the one who covers the gaming side of that, looking at the business and the culture surrounding games. We also do reviews from time to time, and you may have heard that I did a little project called Steam Gauge, where we...
This is how Steam Spy started, actually.
Yeah, we took a look at a random sample of Steam users and tried to extrapolate the sales and gameplay time for a bunch of Steam games about a year ago, and Sergey's Steam Spy came right out of that.
It was based on your talk at GDC, so afterwards I just went and did my carbon copy of your work, but a little bit more accessible.
You took it a little farther in some ways, doing the daily updates and making the data publicly accessible directly to everyone without analysis, so it's a very good extension. I'm glad to see
it. Yeah, I thought about the same way you did. You published a whole Excel file with data, and I thought, well, maybe we could take it one step further, you know, so people would use it. So I added an IPA, and now people are using it, and I think somebody else will make it even more useful. Okay, so back to the topic, I guess. So the first point is what's interesting and what's not to Western press, and I think that's the most relevant question in our discussion, because I see a lot of people just saying, "Well, I made a game, review it," and that's not a story, right? So
it's very rarely a story. It's a game that's like once a year type amazing game, something you've never seen before, totally new gameplay type, really easy to get into and fun. Then yes, maybe some random game will get attention for that. Otherwise, it needs a little something more to get attention because there are hundreds and hundreds of these emails we get every month just asking to look at a game.
Yeah,
take something more to stand out.
I mean, there's so many emails that people don't even have time to try every single game that gets sent. And sometimes you have to battle through tutorial to get to the core. And you just don't have so much time, right, for every game.
Right. At Ars Technica, I'm the only person covering gaming full time. So if I played everything that even just got submitted to me, that would be my full time job. And I would have no time to write about any of it. So, you know, in an ideal world, if I had a 10-person staff and I could say, you check out this game, you check out this game, that would be fine. But that would be a very different site and we'd need a lot more readers, I'd say.
I don't think it would be fine with 10-person Steam because, like, Steam had 1,500 game released last year. And there is an Apple store with 70,000 games released, I think, monthly or daily. So... And every console games as well that you have to cover because, well, they're usually big and worth it. But so no, I don't think 10-person is gonna make it.
it would at least help check out the games that I would like to check out. There's no way to play everything, but maybe everything that I want to have time for, it'd still take a few more people.
So, yeah, well, what I'm trying to say is that if you're developing a game and you're writing to your journalist, you're already in a really tight competition. So obviously not all 70,000 developers are writing to the same journalist, but you just said like several hundreds, right?
Yeah, I'd say easily 100 in a month would not be out of the ordinary.
Yes, you're facing pretty rough competition, and usually you have to decide based on what makes you try the game. I mean, you got an email with a game or link or something. What could make you interested in it? What's it?
So for me, I guess I'll start. I'm looking a lot of games. You could tell even just reading the description or looking at a screenshot that this is just like this other game. Mm-hmm. And I know there's kind of a bias in the press for games that are innovative and games that are original, and maybe that's to our detriment, that there can be some good games that are just extensions of an existing genre or, you know, build a better mousetrap versions of an existing game. But those games are really hard to find usually. Most of the time, if it's like another game, you've already played that other game and it won't really add too much to the experience. I guess what I'm trying to say is you need something to stand out, something that you haven't seen before. I've been doing this for 10 years and, you know, playing games for much longer than that, and it's very hard to find something that I'm not at least familiar with. If you can actually do that, it's very good. It's much easier to write about from that perspective, and much easier to get readers interested in if you can tell them, hey, this is new. This is something you haven't seen before.
I think a lot of the time now as well, it's it seems with a lot of the sort of blogs that are coming out, etc., you know, the people making shorter and shorter posts and just wanting to slap a video into a post and hope they get a bunch of views from that. I'm not cynical at all. I think that just a really damn good trailer, a really good video game trailer, can really do the works these days.
Thing costs money, right? So you can't do just really good video game trailer unless you are good with trailers or you have money to spend.
Yeah, and it's true. But having said that, some games just lend themselves better to trailers, right? Like, yeah. There's some games where you just record the game and it's perfect for a trailer. How long should it be?
Yeah.
It's a good question. I mean, I normally tell developers that they shouldn't be any longer than a minute and a half.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, if you go longer than a minute and a half, I think the majority of people would start to just switch off anyway and become bored. But there's some games, though, that you could just watch for ages, right? Like, I think a kind of recent example, well, from last year anyway, you know, the game called I Am Bread, where you're a piece of bread. And, I mean, when they just put out the video for that, As far as I remember, the trailer was just them playing the game and them just flopping a piece of bread around. Mm-hmm. And because it was hilarious that they were just a piece of bread, then the video got like a million views in a week or something like that. And I mean, yeah, sure. Like, you know, the team behind it, Bossa, they were already well known and they knew how to get in contact with the press and all that. But the fact
they
made
Surgeon Simulator, right? So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, they were the Surgeon Simulator people. But having said that, just, you know, I would believe that any other studio that had made that trailer would still have got quite a lot of views from it, just because it just made sense in a video. And I mean, it's that difficult line of, well, do I just make a game that looks really good in videos then? And
I think, maybe that makes sense. Maybe that's why we don't have text adventures anymore. Well, we do have text adventures, but we don't have major big text adventures anymore.
Yeah,
because
but
it doesn't look good.
You never see like video. You never see trailers blowing up of an indie RPG that's coming out, right? Because indie RPGs, like a turn-based RPG, they don't look like they rarely look incredible in a video. And it's things like that where there's just certain genres that you don't see getting tons of views on YouTube just because they don't work amazing in video. So I mean, it's but then again, like, then people have said to me, well, should I just make a game that looks really good in videos and then people will buy it? And I don't think that's the solution either. It's I don't know, it's finding some kind of balance between the two where you can, your game looks great that people want to watch it, but then also you're making what it is that you actually want to kind of make and play. So yeah, it's tricky. There's so many games that who really knows anymore.
Even more than a YouTube trailer, I've seen some emails recently where they try and distill the game into an animated GIF, which
that's what we do now.
Yeah, like 5 or 10 seconds, and that you don't even have to click on the trailer. The GIF usually loops right in your email client, and you can't avoid seeing what the game is about. And if you have a game that's suited towards, you know, being captured in a 5 or 10 second loop, that can really grab your attention in an email much better even than a video. As Mike was saying, if you don't have a game that's suited to that, you're going to have to find some other way to really grab them. I've seen a lot of people try and, you know, describe their games with text, and, you know, in the first few sentences they try and do something grabby. They'll say, oh, it's like this, it's like these types of games you've never seen for the last 20 years, or imagine this mixed with this, and, you know, it comes off as hokey a lot of the time to me, unless it's really well crafted. It's a tough thing to do because, as we were saying, the attention time is limited, and some of these games just don't do themselves to that quick.
Yeah, what I was wanted to say about GIFs, you don't have to have a game that is like plays in 10 seconds episodes. You just have to have a game with cool moments too, you know, to provide a GIF. For example, like Darkest Dungeon. I really like Darkest Dungeon, and it's a game that drags itself. You have to like play for 30 or 40 minutes to finish a dungeon, but it has a lot of cool moments that are perfect for GIFs. And I learned about Darkest Dungeon when I saw a GIF about guys getting mad in an animation that developer, I think, provided for a Kickstarter. And I think that's a good example because the game is still long, but a GIF is a good way to show off an art style and show off a core mechanics of people getting, you know, going mad in a game.
Yeah, yeah, a game. Sorry, go ahead, Kyle.
I was just going to say, a game like Threes for iOS was one of the first GIFs that I saw that really sold the game very well. It took 10 seconds and showed the tiles morphing into each other, and immediately you knew, oh, that's the game. And it's really easy for a game like that where you can teach it in 5 or 10 seconds. But that was the first example that I can really think of.
Yeah, I mean, the worst is kind of when you get the opposite, where a developer, they just, for a video for their game, they just kind of go to the main menu of their game and start recording, and then just start playing the game. It's like, no, stop this!
Well, they think everything is fascinating about this because they've been working on it for so long that they don't realize that
I just
people, it's not the same.
I just had a talk with my friends just yesterday, and they made a game that has really a lot of options that you have to adjust a lot of options in the game, like change the size of a galaxy and so on and so on. And they're really proud of it, and they start trailer with it. So the first thing you see in the trailer is a huge menu. Yeah. Yes.
Look, the game music mutes.
That's really going to grab you.
I was trying to prove them wrong, like, guys. Nobody gonna play a game because it has a huge menu. It's actually, you know, people are gonna get scared about a game.
So for example, with like we're putting out a game on iOS now, Fearless Fantasy, and it's like a turn-based RPG. So like I was saying, these kind of games, it's difficult to make a trailer for those for games like that. And so what we've done with that is we've just recorded tons and tons of footage of it, and then taken loads of like cool animations from it and cool moments from it and all that kind of stuff, and spliced them all together so that just for, you know, a good sort of 70-80 seconds, it's just action, action, action. It's not just like watching people take turns, because that's not what anybody wants to watch. People want to see the exciting bits of the game so that they know that when they play this game, there are going to be exciting bits and they are going to have fun, and not, it's not just going to be another RPG or something like that.
For something like that, if you can hire, you know, a famous anime studio to draw your characters in super style and, spend hundreds of millions of dollars getting a really tight 2-minute anime trailer, that would be great. But I don't think that's really possible.
Maybe not.
Well, my wife just finished Ni No Kuni, so it is possible, but yeah.
it's rarely possible.
Yes. Yeah, it's like two or three examples of it, right? So I wanted to highlight another thing that, Games Press is not gamers, so they're usually a little bit more familiar with genres, so you don't have to guide them through all your stuff. You just have to highlight really important ones. I mean, you don't have to say, oh, we have an RPG, so you take turns, you kill each other with swords. That's what every RPG has. Say what's different about it.
The one that I hate the most is when someone sends an email about their game and they say, and one of the bullet points is, it has over 100 levels. Yeah, and it's do you understand that I don't care how many levels it's got, because if it's shit, then I don't want to play 100 levels. Tell me what's fun about the game. Don't tell me how ridiculously like drawn out you've made it.
Yeah, it comes from, I think, a few decades ago, that kind of back-of-the-box number-based thing. You know, the higher the number, the better the game was. It was back in the 16-bit days, that was really the thing. And some people have never grown out of that. I don't know why they think that's a big selling point these days.
I don't think it was big selling points like in PlayStation era. It was even before. So it's like 20 years already and people
are
still...
Yeah, it's been a while now. But that kind of gets stuck. These habits die hard.
So
what's the modern selling point then?
Yeah, well, what's your pitch should be to get you interested?
What catches you, Kyle?
I think, like both of us have said now, it's got to be something different. There are so many games out there now. It's harder and harder to stand out, and it's also harder and harder to make something that hasn't been done before, probably in a similar or better way. Even if your game is not entirely new, even if it's based on some other genre or similar to some other game, in a few seconds I have to figure out why this game is something it's not identical to something that I've already played or heard about. If it's a game about flopping around as a piece of bread, I've never played a game like that. That automatically gets my interest, even if the gameplay is similar to something else. It's an entirely new and ridiculous concept. It just has to have something like that these days.
But it's funny though, isn't it? Because then if you look at the top of the App Store, then it's just all the games at the top of there are just all games that are absolutely not new whatsoever. And I mean, obviously the reason for that is because they're paying ridiculous amounts of money advertising.
Right, and that's
it kind of shows the different ends of the spectrum, right? That there's, on one side, it's like, you need something new, and on the other side, it's like, you need something absolutely not new whatsoever.
No, that's fine. I think there's a case, yeah.
sorry. If they want to sell like that, you know, going for the hot trend, making an Angry Birds clone a few years ago would definitely be an easy way to get sales, but it's not the easy way to get press coverage, because I can't write about an Angry Birds clone and have without my readers, you know, saying, why are you writing about this? Why should I be interested in this? Even if some of them would play that and enjoy it, you can't make an interesting story out of it. You can't say, this game is exactly like Angry Birds, and it's got cuter graphics, and maybe you'd like to try it. That's not a very clickable headline.
And then you'll have to write like several hundred articles just like that, because there's several hundred Angry Birds clones, and everyone is a little bit different.
So yes, my new site, angrybirdsclones.com, it's just nothing but that. Hundreds and hundreds of posts.
Angrybirdspy.com.
I spend 100 hours a week just updating it over and over. It's not doing very well.
It just says 000 in all sales data, because that's how it is actually. Another thing is that if you don't have a story in a game, is it worthy to come up with a story? Like we just had a listener ask if it makes sense to use something controversial to push a game, and we already saw it with Hatred, right? The Polish game about killing everyone.
Yes.
It got a lot of press coverage, surprisingly a lot for such a, you know, mediocre game, I'd say. I think it's mostly because it was, well, controversial, right?
I think it was a slow news week.
I
think Polygon wrote like 4 articles about it.
No, it wrote like 20 articles about Hatred.
Yeah, really? I think when it comes to the controversial stuff, I can't think of any examples where something controversial happened with a game and the game saw like a long term
48 results for Hatred on Polygon. So sorry.
Yeah. Is that game out? I don't even know.
It's not out yet.
It's going to be out in summer, I think.
I think. It's a risk to go down that route, quite frankly, because I think there are more. I think there's more examples of a developer trying to be controversial and then just looking like a dick than a developer, you know, sort of getting away with it and actually getting something positive out of it at the end as well.
I also think it might backfire on you a little bit. For every game like Hatred, there are probably 10 others that are trying way too hard to be gross out or very violent just to try and generate that attention. And some of them won't. We can tell a lot of the time if you're trying too hard just to get that angle. Like if you're playing off something in the news, like if I got a pitch today about a Baltimore riot simulator or something, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm totally making this up. But if I got something like that, I might give it a look, but I would, unless it was handled really well, I'd be like, come on, guys, you're just trying to piggyback off the news and in a not very subtle way. It's not a guarantee to getting attention just because it works sometimes.
So you think it's not the real games?
That's not a real game. I just made
it's like attention horse.
Yeah. It was designed specifically to catch a journalist's attention, and it's probably not worth it. But well, Hatred worked, so it might be a way. Just not, I don't think, not an honest way, not an easy way, or not a proven way. Another thing is that you know about the game Dominations, still developed by Brian Reynolds at, you know, of Civilization and Rise of Nations fame. And every single time I read an article about Dominations, which is Clash of Clans clone, actually, it was, well, the guy made Civilization and Rise of Nations, and now he made a Clash of Clans clone, and that was the story in every single article about this game. It got it published, but I don't know if it actually helped to get it attention.
Yeah, nice. Sorry, go on.
I'd say that actually does work pretty effectively across the press in general. If it's a well-known name, you can say, I worked on this well-known game that all your readers love. That's an automatic hook. to at least consider the game. The game itself then has to be worth writing about in context of that. This creator of Civilization, he's now making a game that's like Civilization, but it fixes everything. Or he's not making Civilization at all. He's making an action game. Now, I will at least consider that, and if the game is worthwhile, that's an easy way to get readers interested.
So, yeah, that absolutely works.
If you're already a famous developer, I guess that's great. If you're not, I don't know how good that advice helps you.
Yeah, right. But you might not be a famous developer, but I don't know if you worked for Ubisoft and you worked on Assassin's Creed, and a lot of people in Ukraine, in Kyiv, worked for Ubisoft, in Ubisoft Kyiv, so you might use it, right? So I worked for Ubisoft, then now I'm indie, I'm developing this game, which is absolutely unlike Assassin's Creed. But still, it's kind of like proves that you're actually a developer, you're not just some kid out of your basement, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and like Kyle saying, that the press will, even if you, I've seen loads of stories where someone just emailed around the press saying, hey, I was at, I don't know, let's say Valve for a while, or I was at Rockstar, and now I'm making this game. And so everyone will report on it, and then when you go and check, they were just quite a small person at Rockstar for about 3 months, and that was it. Or they did, like, they just did, I don't know, they weren't even properly at Rockstar, they were just doing some additional work for them. But if you can just, like, throw a name like that, then the press goes, ooh, Rockstar!
Yeah,
that's cool.
That does work for a lot of the press. I've found myself kind of getting numb to that kind of thing. So yeah. If you were the designer of a game, if you were like the big name, you could say creator of that game, that automatically gets attention. But if you just said, I worked at Ubisoft, for instance, there are a lot of people now who used to work at Ubisoft and are now going indie. You hear that pitch over and over and over again, and it doesn't really make you stand out as much as you might think. Now, that said, there might be a storyline to it that could be interesting. Like, for instance, there's a guy who's been making mods for Cities Skylines. Mm-hmm. He's had a Patreon to raise money for just making these buildings and delivering them free to the community. The patrons pay him for this. He's getting about $700 or $800 per building now, based on press attention. And he used to work for SimCity developer Maxis before they shut down. So that's a really interesting story to me.
He used to be a cubicle amazing story.
Doing art and making it for a big heartless company, and then that company shut down, and now he's doing it for himself and asking people to pretty much donate his living. And so I did an interview with him and did really well. I think it worked out well for everybody. So if there's that kind of link there, there might be something to it. But if it's just, I used to work in AAA. Yeah, you and hundreds of other people who are now disillusioned and trying to.
It's Brian Shannon. I just googled him. This is amazing. It's an amazing story. I mean, building might not be amazing, but they are. But I mean, from journalist's point of view, it's a resurrection of SimCity with City Skylines. And I saw a lot of people doing this story about how City Skylines actually SimCity just doesn't have SimCity's name, but everything else. Much better than the original SimCity.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, when we have hundreds and hundreds of games to choose from, we can only write about a few every week. Having something like that narrative that's easy to sell really helps.
Yeah. Awesome. So we talked about how you reply to emails. Do you get approached by other channels? So what's common ways for a developer to meet a journalist, except for just hop for an answer in email.
You can catch them in front of the toilet.
I remember how we got an interview with Kazima this way, actually.
Yeah, serious.
Yeah, we caught him in the toilet.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So it's a joke? So.
No, it's not a joke. It's really, I didn't do this. My colleague did it. He caught a Kojima leaving the toilet, and he wasn't in the toilet with his guards, so he caught him off guard. And, absolutely, seriously.
You can't really get away. I'd say I prefer emails most of the time. I've gotten people who try and send me tweets about it, it's more annoying to me. That's not what I'm looking at Twitter for. That's usually I'm looking there for people I follow. and want to hear from. Other than that, I rarely get phone calls, even though my phone number is kind of out there about it, which is probably for the best. Having to take time out of my day to actually sit there and listen to the person is, there's a lot of stuff going on, and trying to multitask all the time, a phone call really doesn't work with that. And outside of that, when I'm at conferences, I've had people see my name tag and actually try and physically like grab me, come over and see our booth. And if I really don't have anywhere to be, sometimes that actually works, but usually I'm on my way to another appointment. And if you haven't caught me before the show, you're not gonna really have time for my attention.
So email is best way. Everything else is just, you might get lucky, but it's not a strategy, right?
Pretty much, yeah. I kind of live off of my emails, try and filter everything through there. I've got, I'm looking at my list right now, 1,335 unread emails right now.
So it actually makes email is not to be not really reliable way to contact you, because you...
Because I don't read a lot of them, that's true.
No, that's because you have a lot of them. 1,300, that's, I don't know.
That's too much. Still... It's kind of information overload, but at least it's centralized information overload. I know where everything is, I guess, and I can scan through it very quickly and know what I want to pursue.
Okay, I just checked my email box and I have 3 unanswered emails.
you're a much better man than I am.
I just don't get so many emails, I think.
That could be it too.
Yeah, Mike, you made a good presentation at GDC about how people get contact, and could you share some information with us about journalists and YouTubers and Let's Players?
It's Kyle saying the best way to get the press and YouTubers and Twitch streamers is usually through email, but the press get so many emails that it's a lot of it is luck. So the thing is that you might just send an email to a journalist and they are incredibly hungover, or they are very angry that day, or they just can't be bothered. And that happens. It happens to everybody. And so that's the problem, right? Like if you just sent the most important email of your life and the other person's like, ugh, can't bother today, then, it's not going to happen. So you can't, I don't think you can really just hope on a single email that is going to be it, that you are going to get spotted. It doesn't matter, you could try all the things. You can try the putting GIFs in the email. You can try just giving
If the person doesn't open an email, it's not going to help, right?
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't help. So, I mean, that's a problem in itself, which is why you need to have a much longer term plan. You can't just wait until your game is about to launch and then think, oh, I should probably email people now. I should probably talk about the game. You need to have been doing it like for a long time. I usually say to people, you need to have been doing this from the point when your game looks good enough to be able to show in, sort of screenshots and videos. Because if you said a press person, 6 emails over the course of 6 months, then there's far more chance that they're going to open one of those emails than if you just send them one email. Because imagine
what you're going to write if you are not ready to release a game. I just write out of the blue to Kyle, hey Kyle, we are developing Boulder Farming for example, and we're not going to release it for like a year, but here it is.
So imagine if, like, like you say, pretend it's a year before you're going to release the game, right? And imagine you send one to Kyle, okay? And he sees the email, and you've just said to him, we're announcing this game, and here's what it's going to look like, and here's what it's going to be. And Kyle sees the email, and he thinks, I'm not going to cover that at the moment. There's not enough there. I'm not interested in covering that right now. And then a couple of months later, you send him another one. You've made lots more of the game now. You've got some special features about it you want to show. So you send him another one, and he sees it again in his inbox. And there's a chance this time that he remembers it from last time. Maybe he doesn't, but maybe he does. And so he sees it and he thinks, no, I'm still not going to cover it at this point. It still doesn't look like something I'm going to cover. And then, you know, another 2 months later, you've got more to show. And maybe this time he's in the perfect mood. He sees it and he thinks, you know what, actually, it's looking good now. What they've done, I've seen this some cool progression going on here. This feature's something I like. Maybe I will cover it this time. And that's the kind of thing you're looking for. I'm not saying you've got to try and wear people down, like with, you know, you will cover my game. But if you are just, you know, constantly just being very enthusiastic about your game, because this is a game you're making, right? This is something that you love. If you are being enthusiastic about it and you're showing that you really want people to really care about this and you think you've got something really cool, then the chances they're going to cover it are going to be far greater than if you just wait until the last minute and go, oh, hey, I've got a game, please cover it, and that's it.
I'd say that's exactly right. Even if I get a pitch and it's something that it's too early and I'm not going to cover it, if at least I see that email and then it's something I've heard of. And then a few months down the line, if I see another email about it, I'm already primed to at least think about it, at least consider it more. And that's not a guarantee that I'm going to give it enough attention to among all these other games that I have to look at. And it's not a guarantee that I'll write about it, but it does improve your chances quite a bit. You get more bites at the apple, so to speak. And yeah, if I've never heard about you or your game by the time it comes out, then it had better be something incredible to stand out among everything else.
So plan ahead and start contacting press earlier than like in a couple of days before your release.
Yes.
And expect to write several emails to every member of press before you get covered. Oh.
Yes, and I'd also say, you know, cast as wide a net as possible. You know, don't. I wouldn't say anyone is too small to really be below your attention. The wider you send these things, the more chance that someone will cover it. And if from that coverage, you can get more coverage. You know, outside of email, I hear about a lot of games just from looking at blogs or talking to colleagues. And if you can get one person interested and writing about a game, that can often lead to other members of the press giving it attention. You say, oh, this person wrote about it. I guess it might be worth my time, and I'm going to give it a second look.
Yeah, that's just what I wanted to talk about as well. So how you learn about games if somebody doesn't write to you. And I noticed that I follow a lot of press, Russian press mostly, on Twitter, and I saw that someone is playing this game. He says, oh, hey, this game's really cool. And everybody else picks it up. And you could see it in press coverage. Like the side that started to play it first, the guy that started to play it first got the first review or article or something like that. And a day or 2 days later, everybody else follows up because they saw this game from a person they trust, from the colleague, not from a random person on the internet, right?
Yeah, I mean that's how the press works, right? Mm. So the press, the places that the press get games from are their email, from sort of social media. They might see something on Twitter. Maybe like press releases, but then mainly from other press, really. And it's just a lot of regurgitating what everybody else is doing. Because this is the fact is that the press want a lot of people want to kind of, you know, write big grand things, but the fact of the matter is that to kind of keep a website going, you need someone who is also just kind of plowing out the news. And if, for example, Eurogamer sees that Rock Paper Shotgun has written about some game that has just come out, then the chances are they will check that out as well, just to see whether it's worth writing about. Because if Rock Paper Shotgun chose to write about it, then there's a chance that they may also want to write about it. And it just, it kind of all waterfalls like that. There's been loads of times when I've put some news out since I've been at Tiny Build. I've put some news out, and I've seen that like Eurogamer have covered it. And the moment that Eurogamer cover it, I just immediately know, right, okay, so five or six other people are going to cover it now because Eurogamer did. Because that's how it works.
Some of those food sites really feed into everyone. Eurogamer and Rock Paper Shotgun, among them, Kotaku is another one that everyone just, if or GameSpot as well, if it gets on those, everyone else just says, oh, they're writing about it. Must be worth writing about.
Yep. And I feel like everybody's following Reddit games, because I read Reddit games, and like I saw a fresh news on Reddit, and a couple of hours later it pops up everywhere. So I think that might be a way, if you can get to the top of Reddit, it's just also, you know, a challenge.
Yeah,
sure. If easy to say, not easy to do, but yes, if you get high on Reddit, the chances are it'll filter through the rest of the ecosystem.
Yeah. Okay. And so I just think what we discussed is that seems that email is obvious way, is the way you would like to receive information about the game, but it's not the easiest way. It's not most proven way. So.
I don't think there is an easy way though anymore. Yeah. Like, so when I started writing, when I was writing for like indiegames.com in about 2009, I used to get about 6 emails a day, and for about games, and I probably covered about 4 of them.
That's pretty good hit rate.
Yeah, it was amazing. Like the vast majority, I pretty much knew every single indie developer that there was, because there just were none. And now, like, well, you know, kind of the end of the year when I was still writing about games, it was ridiculous. There was way too many games, and there's just, and the problem is as well, there's so much rubbish as well, and it really wears you down. Like, it's horrible to say, but the majority of emails you get are terrible games. And
90% of everything is crap, and that definitely applies in your email box.
Yeah, it absolutely does. So it wears you down, like, having to sift and sift and sift. And when you do finally find that one game, then it's like, oh, I found one game, now I'm going to have a lie down. Never going to look at games ever again. So, yeah, it's very much a case of there are way too many games now.
I really envy that when you got that story of you getting 6 emails a day and finding 4 of them worth covering. I mean, that sounds like the dream right there. How long did that last for before it got ruined?
I think I started to notice the big change around about 2011, maybe.
After Braid.
Yeah, I kind of stopped covering consumer games as much then. So that was fun for me. But yeah, it expanded pretty rapidly.
Yeah. I'll say, actually, outside of email, at conferences, things like the Indie Mega Booth, or areas of conferences where indie games get together and present themselves. So not everyone's going to be able to get a booth or be able to afford the time or the effort to get it. But if you do, I find that at those conferences, that's kind of the time I've devoted myself to finding new games. It's a lot of these games, they might be actually sitting in my email, and I could find them and write about them if I wanted to sift through. But one, I've got tons of other things going on when I'm at my computer. As Mike said, you have to kind of churn out the news and keep up with everything that's going on. And secondly, if you're confident enough in your game to actually get a booth, that's a sign of quality to me. That automatically filters out a lot of the people who do not have the confidence or the resources to really put attention towards these games. I find that the hit rate I get, if I just go to a random game at a convention like this and start playing it, it's a much better chance of being a game that's interesting or that I might want to write about than if I just open a random email and start playing that game.
Yeah, so it's not really expensive, right? Alex, he wrote an article about doing a booth at PAX, and you could get a booth space for free with Indie Mega booth, and sometimes some conferences provide a space for free for developers, like DevGam does. Igromir, I think, will be doing this as well. It's in Russia, and I think in Gamescom you could get a place space for free if you're indie. It's not going to be a main show floor. It's going to be community show floor, but it's still a lot of people, like 300,000 people.
Mike would know more about that, I think, than me.
Yeah, I mean, it's expensive. If you're going to do it like properly, it can be expensive at these things. But to be honest, you don't need to do it properly. Like, my brother is making a game at the moment, and what he's doing to get noticed, and he's doing fairly well for himself, he's going to events, and then he's just being incredibly forward and just walking up to people, like he's kind of finding who the press people are and just walking straight up to them and going, "Hi, do you have 10 minutes? I'd like you to play my game," and just putting his laptop in front of them. And
he, yeah, I used to do that as well. It's actually it works, absolutely.
Yeah, it absolutely works. What he does now is he'll go to like a big game show, he'll find where the press room is, and he'll just stroll into the press room. He'll just flash his badge, his consumer badge, and just stroll into the press room, just sit down in the press room, and as the press are coming in and out of the room, just say to them, "Hey, have you got a spare moment? Do you want to play a game?"
I've used to stalk a press room in at E3. I wouldn't go inside, but stalk outside. It works as well, actually.
So personally, I would find that pretty annoying. The press room, to me, I often, when I'm trying to work on a story, I'll hear someone two seats down trying to give a demo of their game, and then I have to put on my noise-canceling headphones and really try to tune
it
out.
And honestly, it would irritate me as well, especially if it was my brother who walked into the room and did it. But the point is that, like, as much as it irritates some people, it does work, because like he went to Rezzed recently, which is kind of like a Eurogamer festival in the UK, and he came away with he was in like The Guardian and in Eurogamer and all these ones for his game.
I could see that working in the lobby or, you know, on the show floor, even if you have a portable game that's easy to show like that. I could see being, you know, even if not everyone says, "Yes, I have 10 minutes to spare," you're going to see enough people that a few of them will see the game, if you don't have a booth.
I think it's like every 10th person says yes, but it's still a lot of press at E3.
There's just so many people, and that's more. Yeah. That's probably a better hit rate than you would get with email. But I would just say stay away from the press room or around there, because if I see you trying to pitch there, that's going to make me 100% less likely to.
If you see him next time, punch him in the face. That's what he deserves.
All right.
We were talking about excitement in showing a game. I think there's one area that Russian developers are a little bit lacking, because in Russian culture it's you shouldn't be excited, because it's bad to be excited. You should be calm. I meant the thing.
Being excited is the number one thing you have to be. When I talk to a developer and they are obviously excited about the game they are showing me, then it makes me happy to be checking the game out as well.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen Russian person genuinely being excited?
I've seen a number, like when I went to DevGam, and you know, there's the I think it's called Gameplay.
But you were in Minsk, right?
Yeah, when I was
It was around Russians, Belarusians or Ukrainians.
Oh, okay. Not the same thing. I get what you're saying, but there were some people, and they're the games that I remember in my head. Like, there was a game called Basement. I remember a game called Basement when I was talking to the guy who made Basement, he was like, "Oh, and this is what we're doing with the game, and we're going to do this, and we're going to..." And he was excited about it. And so I remember that game now. In fact, I think it came out on Steam today, funnily enough.
Seriously? Basement?
Yeah. Oh, no, I think so. I think it's on Early Access. But I mean, it's really important, and if it's something that you find difficult to do, sort of be be, you know, I guess loud. That's the word you could use to describe me. You know, it's,
it did come out today. I'm surprised I haven't heard from Dmitry. He always writes about it. Yeah, it did come out. Cool.
Yeah, maybe he's trying to. Maybe he's trying to be quietish about it.
No, I don't think he can actually. He's not the kind of person.
but yeah, it's the thing. It's the one thing that I think more developers need to do, just be visibly excited about their games, because it really does help. It really does.
Yeah, I would say if Russian culture really is not predisposed to that, I would just tell your Russian listeners that when you're excited about a game to a Western journalist, it will not come off as rude. It will not seem inappropriate. It will seem like you're interested in this game, and I should be interested in this game because of your interest. So keep that in mind if you're not talking to a Russian.
Just show your emotions. Don't behave like you're. And, yeah.
Exactly.
It's
a Russian robot.
Yeah, well, you know how well you met Russians. You know that they don't show the emotions because that's considered to be bad in Russian culture.
And so just keep telling yourself that's not how it will seem to them. Even if this feels wrong to me, that's not how it's coming off.
Yeah, yeah. So they can't read your mind, unlike other Russians, so they don't can't understand. Your raised bro is actually a sign of excitement inside. You just have to be
excited. Just be confident.
Yeah. Another question is, are press, and I wanted to cover to YouTubers as well, but let's start with press. Are you actually a viable and effective promotional channel? Because we talked about how App Store is occupied by companies that spend lots of money on direct advertisement. And we are not talking about Apple sales right now because it's complicated, but PC or console, do you think that press is a viable channel for promotion at all? Maybe you shouldn't just talk to press at all. Maybe you should just go some other way. I don't know, buy TV advertisement or something like that.
If you can afford to buy a TV advertisement, go ahead and do that. That's definitely going to beat the press. But the press will be cheaper, I guess, if you can actually get written about. So I think for return on investment, if you can get some interest in from a bunch of media sites, and you have a story that they're willing to tell, they're not going to charge you anything for that. Will it actually sell games? It depends on the game. It depends on how it's written about, how widely. There's no guarantee that just because there's an article that it will turn into sales. But if there's no articles, then none of that will turn into sales, and you're just relying on people finding it on these very crowded storefronts. So I think you have to try and get every advantage you can, as far as that goes.
Yeah, I mean, I've always told developers, well, I've told developers this for a long time, and this is what we do now. The press is important because the press, getting press for your game is a catalyst for lots of other things. So, for example, if we want a feature on the App Store, then having press is something that Apple will ask you for. Apple will say, as part of their, you know, sort of application, right, can you link us a dozen places where your game has been talked about? And, you know, if by showing them where you have got press, you're number one, you're showing them that people actually care, and that some people feel like your game is interesting enough to report on. Mm-hmm. And two, it shows that you're actually trying. It shows that you're putting the effort in to talk about your game, because if you are, you know, if you're trying to get sales, then Apple are going to want to feature you, because then they're going to get more sales for featuring you, right? Mm-hmm. And it works the same with, say, YouTubers. You know, you really want, if you've got a PC game out, you really want someone like, you know, Total Biscuit or Jesse Cox or someone like that to play your game, because you know that a video from one of them, a positive video from one of them, is going to lead to lots of sales.
Yeah, but it's not going to guarantee it, right? Because I've been checking since the Steam launched. I've been checking on how games are doing after getting reviewed by big YouTubers, and it actually depends on the game. It helps obviously, even if the game is not really good, it's going to move some thousands copies. But yeah, it's not a guarantee. So if you got a million views from YouTubers, it doesn't mean that you're going to sell even a, you know, couple of thousand copies, because.
Yeah, no, you need a bit of everything. Like,
yeah.
So when your game's coming out, you don't just want that single video from Total Biscuit and that's it. You can sit back and open the champagne now. You right. you need like videos from lots of big YouTubers at launch, and you need some Twitch streamers playing it, and you need Kotaku and Rock Paper Shotgun and blah 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 writing about it, and you need people talking about it on Twitter and on Steam forums. That would be the perfect storm, right? If you manage to get all of those different things, the chances are you won't get all of those things, because that's impossible. But unless you're, you know, Ubisoft and you're probably paying for it. But I mean, at the end of the day, you want that's what you're aiming for. And if you can get a bunch of press in the months running up to the launch of your game, all of these YouTubers, when you then try, you know, ask them to write about your game, when they go and Google your game, they will find, you know, all of these articles which have been written. And again, they will think to themselves, well, maybe there's something worth covering here if all of these press people are writing about it.
Yeah, hopefully, as Mike said, it will snowball into something. One article alone, no matter, even if it's on the biggest site in the world or from the biggest YouTuber in the world, will not send your game into the stratosphere of sales alone. But it will likely lead to more coverage, more people tweeting about it, and therefore other people will see it and maybe cover it as well. You're hoping for that snowball effect, and it has to start somewhere.
If I'm getting what Mike is talking about, right, that you have to push a lot of things, so you don't have to rely on press or YouTubers alone, you have to push as many channels as you can, and then hopefully you'll have a perfect storm. But even if you won't have a perfect storm, you'll have some coverage from some sources that gonna help you, you know, promote a game.
Yeah, you need to do everything. I mean, if you're not doing everything, then like as harsh as it sounds, like it's a bit like, well, how much do you want to succeed, right? How much do you want your game, which you've spent all these months, to sell? How, like, it's so important just to be doing all this stuff, and yeah, it's annoying to have to do it all, and it can be hard going and it can be a slog, but at the end of the day, it's necessary. And I mean, this some people will just not want to do it, and that's why there are some companies that will help them do it, like Tiny Build, like Devolver and Curve, and all of these kind of companies that are around now can help out with all this kind of stuff if you really cannot be bothered. But you need to be doing it in some form, because you can have the greatest game in the world and just think, oh, I'll contact the press as it's coming out, it'll be fine. And you can just end up with no one having any clue that your game came out. And I've seen it happen loads of times. It happens all the time. So, yeah.
And I will say along those lines, going with an indie publisher like a Devolver or a Tiny Build does increase the chances that I will give your game attention. If they've put their stamp of approval on it, they say, pretty much, they've picked up a game, they say, okay, we think this game is good enough for us to try and sell. Then when I see in my email box it comes from one of these indie publishers, I say, oh, they've picked good games in the past. This is less likely to be a waste of my time if I give some attention to it. It's not never a guarantee that, you know, I don't cover every Devolver game, for instance, but it definitely increases the chances that I will look at the game without just skipping over that email in my inbox.
Yeah, except Devolver, though, because all of their games are crap. I really want to start a war. I want to start some kind of indie publisher war so much you don't understand.
It'll be the new EA versus Activision.
Yeah.
Tiny Build versus
so
Devolver.
So much want to do it.
Yeah, figure out.
It would be actually an interesting story, right?
Yeah, it would be brilliant if we just we were at there was an award show earlier this month actually that I went to in the UK where it was like an indie publisher award that we were all up for, sort of Devolver and Kurt. And just before it, we were all tweeting each other, like sort of tweeting horrible things at each other. And then in the end, like 505 Games won it. So it was like, oh well.
You have to set up like a viral video in the halls of E3, like you guys run into each other and suddenly a brawl breaks out and you're calling each other names and it gets on YouTube.
I would love that. If you see that happen, Kyle, then you know what's going down.
Okay, I'll keep my mouth shut, though. I won't tell everyone that it's staged.
You just have to get Devolver involved, so set up a plan of, you know, war. Yeah. Obviously.
Maybe into that, if I know them.
Indie publishers make sense if you know the right indie publisher. Well, we have Tiny Build, we have Evolve, we have other guys, we have actually marketing agencies like Evolve, Plan of Attack, and so on that would also contact the press for you. But as I wrote in a book, that nobody gonna do a tough job for you. People will contact for you, but they won't, you know, come up with a story or anything.
I'd actually be interested to know, Mike, what's the best way to get an indie publisher to notice you? Is it similar to trying to get press attention, or is it just knowing the right people?
Yeah, I'd say it is, you know. I'd say it's like, I think that's why I fell into this job pretty easily, just because I basically carried on doing what I'd been doing. Like, it is essentially just kind of watching the email, and I mean, I'll watch other places more, you know, kind of harder than I would have before, I guess. So I'll watch Twitter and I'll watch Reddit and things like, you know, this the game jam that we were talking about earlier that happened, the game competition. These kind of things are places where I like to find games as well. I think we've signed recently 2 games from ones that we found from DevGam. So like you were saying, going to events really helps with this kind of stuff. It's very much a lot of the same kind of thing. So if you are trying to get an indie publisher to care about your game, then it's very much in the same kind of field as trying to get the press to care about your game as well.
Well, what I say is that actually it might be easier to get a publisher's attention, because you could set up a meeting at GDC easy with a person from a publisher, because that's a job, that's a business. As a journalist, your business, your customers are your readers, and as a publisher, that's part of your business, you know, game developers. So they will meet you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and I want to talk about press releases, because I officially hate press releases. I think that's a dumb use of official, you know, sounding stuff that people just copy-paste. Company X is proud to announce, and the Company X is actually 2 guys walking out of the basement, and it kind of sounds stupid when they pretend to be a big company. It's like, play. But I don't know, I still get a lot of press releases, despite not being a press, and I guess you get a lot of them as well. Do you think they still make sense, or...
For an indie developer, I'd usually say no, unless you have something that's really newsworthy on its own, that's not related to your game, but it would just generally be news from an industry perspective, which you probably don't. You probably just promote your game. I think people think it's kind of required because everyone else does it, and you know, if you're a AAA publisher, I can see reasons to do it. But
if you're a public company, you have to do press releases. That's the requirement.
Exactly, and that's why people kind of ape that style. But if you're an indie publisher, no, just write in your own voice. Tell me why it's interesting without the stilted press release language. I'm more likely to tune it out if I see that format and see a headline that's trying too hard to be grabby as a press release.
Okay, and what's your opinion on press kits? Because that's another thing that people, they don't forget about press releases, but sometimes they do forget about press kits. And I just wanted to take a chance to promote Do Press Kit by Rami Ismail. It's an amazing free service to create your press kits. But just to ask, if it's, do you really need press kits? Do you rely on them?
It's very useful on our side too. I'd say that comes at the point where I've already decided to write about your game. If I've gotten that far, then I will look at the press kit. Oh, here are the images I can put in. Mm-hmm. Here are some, you know, extra details that I might not have to send back an email and ask about. You know, but stuff that I wouldn't necessarily need to see in the original email. But if I'm going the next step, I could look into the press kit and get the additional information. So I'd say that's important to have, but mm-hmm. it's not going to help you with that first step of getting attention. It's kind of the second layer.
It's more of an easy way for press to get all your assets and all your information once they got interested. It's not going to get interested, right?
Right. I don't look at the press kit for games for every game that I get just to see, oh, now there's five more screenshots that weren't in the email. Yeah. I'm not going to go that far unless the first screenshot got me interested already.
I mean, I think the majority of press people, just all they need for making a news post, for example, about your game, they could do with a video, like a link like to a YouTube video would be good, because most sites can just embed a YouTube video. And then just a few images of a game and a logo that they can just play around with and resize to fit their website. I don't think there's many websites which would need more than three curated screenshots, you know? Mm-hmm. That's pretty much... Well, and then just obviously just a page that has some additional information, maybe.
Some really basic info, yeah.
Yeah, maybe just in bullet point form. You know, just super simple so that
don't,
you can just...
Don't have to be fancy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think some developers think that you need way more than that. Like, you need masses and masses of screenshots, and I never in the 8 years I wrote about video games looked through like a page when a developer had like a page of 30 screenshots or something. I didn't go through them all trying to find the best screenshot. I just chose the first one.
So. It's because you worked in online media. If you worked at press and printed press, we were obsessed with screenshots because that takes a lot of space on a page. And we had an art director that would go through every single screenshot and shout, "It's a bullshit! I need a new one, a new batch," and we would get a new batch from a developer, and that's from print magazines. But I don't think anybody reads print magazines anymore, at least in gaming.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot easier than that now.
Yeah, you get a Game Informer when you buy something at GameStop, but I'm not sure anybody reads it in paper. It's online anyway, right?
Yeah,
yeah. But if you're Grand Theft Auto 5. I could see, having 60 screenshots, everyone's going to put them in a gallery or pick the best one, or if you're a AAA game. But if you're an indie game, don't knock yourself out. Just have half a dozen.
Especially if they all look the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and I want to talk about YouTubers and Twitch streaming. I do understand that we don't going to go too deep into this because that's a huge area, and we already had some podcasts about Twitch and YouTube with guests from Twitch and YouTube, but I would like your opinion on this thing. What should be done different compared to press? And I mean, we talked about writing to press a year earlier, but do you think that writing to, I don't know, Total Biscuit a year earlier before a game release is going to help me to get his attention?
Not Total Biscuit, because
he's special, right? Okay.
He doesn't care. No, Total Biscuit is interesting because he's too big now. He only covers big games now, as far as I understand it.
No, he covers some indie games. I follow up Total Biscuit.
So for example, E3 is coming up. He's only seeing AAA at E3, as far as I understand. He won't be seeing any indie games there. And so it's difficult, right? I don't know how many indie developers are going to go to E3 anyway. But that kind of thing is tricky, right?
Even covered this funny game by Dagestan about Russian clone of Hotline Miami, which is absolutely ridiculous. Ludbeskovkas, okay. It didn't help sales, obviously, but he did cover it.
No, exactly. And I mean, the whole sort of getting YouTubers and Twitch streamers to care, I think the main difference is that these people, they don't care about you having some kind of story, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, the press... like to have a narrative for what they're going to write, because like Kyle says, no one just writes game developer is releasing game as a story. They need some kind of story, whereas, you know, people who are making video, they need the opposite. They need a game that looks really cool in a video. So that is what they are looking for, which is why you want to make you want to make the game itself and what the game looks like the big feature of when you're trying to talk to these people, basically, I think is the big difference, really.
Yep, I would say that you should ignore videos and just pay attention to people who are writing things, like me. People who are on videos are not the future. They can't get videos are
YouTube is so 2006, man.
Yeah, no one's watching those videos anymore. Everyone's reading nowadays.
Yeah, yeah. Medium all the way. Writes long articles. Yeah.
But seriously, I don't have much. Expertise in this field, but I am constantly worried that people are going to stop reading and just going to watch footage from these big YouTubers and put me out of the job. So don't do that.
Well, I think it just complements each other, right? You read a little bit about a game, then you go watch some YouTuber ramble about it.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to think that you can do stuff with the written word that. In a different way, it's a little more thoughtful and gets behind the game in a way that you can't get just watching someone play it. But so hopefully there's room for both.
So for YouTubers, you have to focus on visual style and on actual playability of the game. So you can't just write an email, we're going to have a game in a year, because, they don't care. They want a game when it's playable, right?
Yeah. I don't think there are many YouTubers who are just reading the news of upcoming releases into a camera—that's not very compelling.
Yeah, and I don't think catching YouTubers at the expo works, because they don't usually go to many expos, at least not to game developers conferences. They would go to E3, obviously, but I don't think I saw anyone at GDC.
Yeah, I think YouTubers, but also Twitch streamers, I think they go to things like PAX. When we were at PAX East, we met quite a lot of YouTubers and Twitch streamers. I mean, we had we did a couple of sessions on the Twitch stage, and when we were kind of mingling, there was a lot of YouTubers and Twitch streamers coming up to us and talking to us. But then, you know, I was at like GDC earlier in the week, and I don't recall seeing a single I think I knew of a couple who were there, but I don't really recall bumping into any. It's definitely consumer shows, I think, that these people are going to, really.
Yeah, actually, in Russia, I meet people at Igromir, I meet YouTubers at Igromir, and funny thing is that a lot of people don't recognize them, because they look a little bit different in real life. They don't shout at you, as they do on videos. So people just miss them, and as developers, including developers as well.
Yeah.
So it's not a good way. But on the other hand, I saw in your presentation that YouTubers aren't getting so many emails as press. So you could just write to them, and it's not going to be. They might actually read your email. They might not reply because they're not interested, but they have a higher chance of reading it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, so like, so we're, you know, obviously one of the games we've got at the moment is Party Hard, and we have been letting YouTubers know about this. And the first like couple, we've basically been giving out like prototype builds of this game to YouTubers to see if they want to try some of the levels. And at first, not a lot of people were playing these builds. And then gradually, like, so the last one we put out, we got a lot of people playing and recording the build we put out last. And it's like I was saying earlier, these people have now seen emails from us multiple times. And so this time when they've seen it, it just happened to be, you know, the right moment for them to be playing it. And then they see other YouTubers playing it. And so they play it because of that. And it's that kind of, just getting in touch with these people multiple times and letting them know what you're doing. You eventually start to see results from it.
Okay, and this Twitch crowd is even more complicated, because they usually only play the games that were released already, right?
Yeah, I mean, with Twitch, it's tricky because a lot of people Twitch is just a whole different world. You know, there's Twitch streamers who just play Dota and that's it, and there's some who just play Hearthstone and that's it.
It makes sense. Like if you think about us, like an ESPN, ESPN doesn't play every single new sports that they invent. They just play, exactly, you know, soccer and football and whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it becomes a little bit more tricky, and it becomes tricky as well because it's really difficult to actually work out who these people are and, you know, and find contact details from them, etc. It's a world that we've been like exploring, and it's once you start to understand what it is that these people want. So, like Twitch streamers, they really just want ways to expand their audiences, basically, and to expand their communities. Mm-hmm. So, if you can give them, you know, sort of stuff to give away, if you've got a game on Steam and you can give them codes to give away while they're playing your game, you can give them games to play because a lot of them play with other streamers, so if you've got a multiplayer, mm-hmm, online multiplayer game that they can play together, that works as well. But again, just like with the YouTubers, it's a case of just keep getting in touch with them and, you know, sort of hope that eventually you get through to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best you can hope for, really.
So people in the, I see people in the chat are discussing whether snail mail is a good way to get attention. I would say that would definitely be unexpected. I don't think an indie developer. Well, a few indie developers actually have sent me swag for a game, and I mean, it definitely gets me to pay attention more than an email would, but it's still not a guarantee that I would find the game interesting.
I think some people get freak out about it because we wanted to send an actual mail to Total Biscuit, and we were advised against it by PR agency because they said he's gonna freak out. He's really cautious about his personal life. So, and we just wanted to send him a thank you, not you know, bribe or anything, but just
yeah. I wouldn't. It's going to cost a lot more than email on your end for sure, but it would stand out because I do not get much snail mail from indie developers or even for AAA developers these days.
Yeah, they used to send postcards all the time and review copies as well. So nowadays you just get a code. That's actually better, but not as romantic, I guess. Right?
Yeah. But more efficient.
Yeah, that's the way to say it. Another last topic I wanted to cover is that own media. That own media is that every company has a blog or Twitter or maybe Twitch channel, or if it doesn't have a Twitter, you know, owner of a company of lead designer might have a Twitter, and what to do with all those resources from your point of view. Is it, well, obviously it's not a press, but you could use it, right? What would you expect from it?
It doesn't hurt to do those things, but usually I would recommend that, I guess, for companies that already have a few well-known games under their belt. If it's your first title, I don't know why I would follow your Twitter unless I'm already interested in the title for some other reason. I wouldn't just I don't usually just go searching Twitter for new game developer feeds, for instance, or on a blog, you might be able to flesh out a little bit more than you could do in an email. More about the development process, more about how the game is shaping up and how it's different. But I'm not going to visit that blog unless you know, I'm here about it through an email. Probably.
Kyle, do you think if you saw that a developer had lots of followers on Twitter, do you think that would cause you to potentially cover them over a developer who barely had any followers on Twitter?
No, I don't say I usually look at the follower count for a developer. If I want to follow them, I will follow them. Mm-hmm. If other people follow them, it's so easy to game those follower counts and buy Twitter followers. There's ways to check that, I guess. But no, I really wouldn't cover it. But on the other hand, if there was someone who I knew, who I follow on Twitter, who tweets at a developer that I've never heard of, or is in a conversation with them, or says, you know, game, this game from apt game developer is really good, then I might click on that because it's a personal recommendation from someone that I know and follow. So quality more than quantity for referrals like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, that makes sense. It might be used as an additional source of information, but it won't be, you know, your contacting point, right?
Because how am I going to find it unless you tell me about it, or it might be a useful thing for other people to point to if they're interested in your game and want to spread it on social media. Mm-hmm. So having them around doesn't hurt, but it's usually for the press. It's usually not going to be the first thing I hear about your company. Is probably not going to be your Twitter account or your blog.
Yeah. Okay. I think I'm done here with my questions. Anything you wanted to add or about it?
I'll just say that, you know, even from this end, I realize it's not a very fair system. It's very hard to get the press's attention in general, or a specific person especially. And a lot of it is luck, you know, the mood or the person you're trying to contact that day. Sending a few emails over time, as Mike said, is a very good strategy for getting more bites at the apple. But really, my best advice is have something interesting to say about your game, or have a game that's interesting in its own right. Stuff that's not in some way different than what has been done before, and that's the best way to get my attention.
Kyle, okay. When are you going to stop writing about games and start doing some kind of analytics stuff?
I feel like I can do both. I do analytics in my writing all the time. I kind of feel like that helps set me apart a little bit. But I don't know if any of the big analyst firms want to throw tons of money at me for my for my skills. Maybe I'll take it under advisement.
Sounds perfect to me.
Yeah, it's basically the same job. You do all this stuff, researching companies, contacting people, but you just don't write about it for general audience.
I don't know if Steam Spy is hiring its second employee yet to really make a business out of it, but I could throw my hat in the ring.
Yeah, right now Steam Spy, I think, is minus €40 in profits.
Well, if you hire me, I can make that minus 80 very quickly. All right, guys.
Yeah, thank you for coming. We had some questions in live stream, but I think we answered most of those. So I don't think we're going to need additional Q&A sessions. Thank you for coming. Thank you for taking this time. And thanks to everyone for listening, for, you know.
Who's arrived?
Yeah, it's like 1 a.m. actually in Kyiv and Moscow. So thank you, guys. I know we went to tough competition in live against Tim Schafer with Broken Age. He was playing it live. Till.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, guys. It's been fun.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yes. Okay.
And thank you so much, everyone.
Oh, Lurk, you're still here.
It was a lot. Thank you.
Awesome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.